Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Lovely to see a full house. I think this evening's event is going to be really exciting. Our speakers are going to be thinking about monstrosity in various different ways. So let me introduce them. So our first speaker is Fred Botting, who is Professor of English Literature and Creative Writing at Kingston University. Next is Stephen Shakespeare, who is Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at Liverpool Hope University. And our final speaker is Sarah Wood, who is Reader in English Literature and Literary Theory at the University of Kent. So each of our speakers will speak for about 10 minutes, and then there'll be lots of time for discussion and for questions from the audience. So our first speaker is Fred Botting.
Well, what I'm going to do, or sketch briefly, is a kind of literary, political, philosophical taxonomy of modern monstrosity. It starts with the assumption that humans are an invented category from, let's say, roughly around the 18th century, due to a number of economic, political, philosophical, literary forces, and there can be no humans without monsters, and vice versa. The four categories I'm going to briefly outline with a couple of examples along the way are what I want to call the didactics of monsters. The function of monstrosity is to teach and define boundaries. An ethics or a politics of monstrosity, in which questions of humanity are defined in relation to monsters and systems that are defined as monstrous. Thirdly, what I'm going to call the erotics of monstrosity. It could be better titled, perhaps, the kind of abjection of monsters. And here there's a sort of greater intimacy. And then the final category I've really struggled with is to do with kind of contemporary forms of monstrosity after modernity. How those kind of differences that I'm going to spell out could be defined. So whether it would be called a technics and anaesthetics, a therapeutics, an autistics of monstrosity, the kind of terms on which modern monstrosity and modern humanity are based are thrown into disarray. So the kind of philosophical, theoretical frameworks I'm working from are kind of more literary philosophical. Thinkers like Michel Foucault's Histories of the Production of Knowledge. Thinkers such as, later on, Jacques Derrida and the kind of textuality of monsters. And in between, the importance of the kind of thinking of Julia Kristeva on the boundaries of culture, self, and body. What I'm going to start with then is a kind of dating. And the dating only indicates key areas, not so much techniques or modes that appear and then disappear. So when I talk about the didactics, there are still the functions. Those functions carry on, but they're less dominant as we move out of the kind of late 18th century and into a kind of early 19th century romantic period. There you see more political and more definitely sort of recognisably human forms. By the end of the century, with kind of fantasy X degeneration anxieties, that's where I think the kind of erotics, the intimacy, the repulsion, the disgust around monstrosity comes to the fore in trying to delineate cultural boundaries. And then the sort of late 20th century contemporary period is where I struggle. So the first question is, what do monsters do? One, they delineate boundaries. They reinforce, reproduce boundaries of body, culture, system. They mark out a history of norms. But they do so by threatening those boundaries, by disturbing them or threatening to disturbing them, by exceeding them. So there's a kind of dynamic that Foucault talks about in Preface to Transgression, where norms, prohibitions exist only because of the limits and the crossing that they enact. So there's always a dynamic between limit and excess, and that's kind of informing what I'm kind of doing. The other aspect is monsters function as things which give form to excesses, voids, breaks that have yet to be named. So they mark out and protect us from, screen off particular limits. And this way they might function like Kant's noumenon, this place where philosophy must not go, as it delineates the categories of thought and phenomenon. So stage one, because I haven't got much time. Didactics. This would be associated probably with the kind of early Gothic novel, late 18th century accounts of fiction. There, the monster works, is supposed to work in a very clear way. It draws on kind of medieval morality play logic, in which to put a monster on stage, to put a villain on stage, is to put an evident figure of vice on display so that the audience can learn and understand that this is vice, that it is not to be imitated, and that the virtues that are also outlined in a drama or in a novel should be respected. This becomes, towards the end of the century, increasingly a problem as kind of novels turn into romances, turn into Gothic fictions. The concern about reading and private reading was also a concern about how to discriminate good, proper social values from more fanciful, vicious, degenerate, licentious identifications and excitements. And in the criticism, there's a lot of concern about what young ladies should or shouldn't read, how these adventurous, dark, exciting Gothic fictions might tempt them to disobey their fathers, etc. And quite a strong amount of criticism there. The key sort of phrase, which I'm now struggling for, would be from Pope's Essay on Man, where he writes, "Vice is a monster of so frightful a mien as to be hated needs but to be seen. There should be a clear, easy to discriminate distinction between virtue and vice." That gets increasingly thrown into display, and then around this period, it's around the French Revolution, it begins to shift. Monsters seem to be all over the place, not just at home, abroad, in France, and the concerns are about the, in Britain, with the writings particularly of Edmund Burke, the effect of French democratic republican ideas and their terrible political and economic practices. And Burke very much sets out a contemporary political sketch of monstrosity. Everything in France is monstrous. It threatens British good order. And so he writes of the French Revolution as a monstrous, tragicomic scene. It's the entirety of events and discussions of it becomes a monstrous fiction. The National Assembly is a monster. The Constitution is a monster. The attempt then is to draw clear lines, but in a context of them being constantly under pressure and rethought. This cartoon, which of course, as you know, copies Fuseli's more famous painting, is a British sleeper having nightmarish dreams about the revolution affecting British political ideas, and you can't quite see it, but he has been reading, and the jacket pocket has a book title on it, Political Justice, Godwin's Inquiry Concerning Political Justice. That is one of the texts that in this period, like Richard Price's Defence of the French Revolution, that Burke sets out to rebuff. The concern then is British radicalism. So the writings of Tom Paine, Richard Price, William Godwin, and Mary Wollstonecraft. And for them, a very different set of monsters appear. In Paine, in Burke, and in Wollstonecraft, it's always the feudal system and its governmental forms that are monstrous. So, aristocracy, patrilineage, government by courts and ministers. And this becomes the figure of monstrous tyranny, systemic monstrosity. That, Wollstonecraft, in her Vindication of Rights of Men, says, well, this is the system that makes humans monstrous, that prevents sensitive, rational, thinking beings becoming truly human, not giving them democratic rights, etc. This model is probably played out most fully, and I won't go into it here, in The Daughter of Godwin and Wollstonecraft, Mary Shelley's famous monster, Frankenstein, in which a kind of dynamics of tyranny, the making of monsters, are played out. Now I'm going to jump through. There are various political forms of the Frankenstein model that come out around political debates, unleashing powers that one cannot control, but also turning Irish debates, repeal of the Reform Act, that's Peel in Birmingham, become a kind of way of constructing class, the mob, as a threatening, many-headed monster. But by the end of the 19th century, there are sort of slightly different concerns about the cultural production of monsters around another familiar gothicized monster, Dracula's vampire. But this would be located in a period of Victorian scientific development, materialism, meets that sense of cultural decline, where various thinkers, scientists, anthropologists, think Lombroso with Criminal Man, versions of atavism, even Darwin's wonderfully entitled The Descent of Man, signal a kind of de-evolution, a cultural breakdown. Now here, the monster takes the form of a thing with a capital T. And in a lot of the fictions, it is thing with a capital T. Dracula, Lucy in Dracula, Hyde in Jekyll and Hyde, and various other stories. And this thing condenses a range of cultural anxieties that are both close to its own models of self-representation, and at the point where its borders become permeable, problematic, sticky, a matter of kind of both, if you like, desire and fear, or attraction and repulsion. And there are various scenes in accounts of those novels and at the time where that kind of polarisation around cultural collapse occurs. Here, Kristeva's model of the abject, that point at which subjective identity, cultural identity, is threatened by all sorts of leaky fluids, unsanctioned desires, and attempts to put itself back together. From there, I begin to struggle. These earlier forms of monstrosity that begin to mark out and reconstitute, often in disgust, in horror, a sense of the human, begin to fall apart. And then one might think of the way that monsters become more sympathetic, more normalized. Monsters, rather than being limit or extreme figures, become part of a kind of transvaluation. They're attractive. Vampires in movies from the 80s, think Anne Rice onto even Twilight. That they become no more than the boy or girl next door. That the kind of monstrosities that they were are now charged much more with consumer behaviour, sexual desire. Or they're thoroughly normalised. Which is where telling the difference, or being able to mark out the difference, or being able to constitute and define human social, cultural, political boundaries through monstrosity becomes problematic. So vampires become sexy. How do you know if you're not a clone or a zombie, especially if you do those philosophical experiments? Or with kind of medical treatments, cloning, technological supplementation, we're all already very much part of that transformation. So for me, older models of a kind of modern humanity no longer work or get defined with these newer senses of monstrosities that aren't really monstrosities. They're more, as Jacques Derrida says, pets. So you can have all sorts of hideous things and popular associations. Genetic experimentation. It makes you smile. You take a familiar Boris Karloff photo, slap in between two buns. It kind of renders the future both safe and commodifiable. The disgusting things are toned down. Monsters more and more become figures of fun or protection. Even in the daily practices like the Bride of Wildenstein, which kind of become part of the everyday fare of Hello Magazine and Before and After. The question of telling the difference of norms, otherness, cultural boundaries no longer works, is my contention with monsters. And that's where I shut up and get put right by the next speakers.
Thanks very much. Our next speaker is Stephen Shakespeare.
There are monsters in this room. Lots of them. Lots of us. In fact, if there are any Greek men in the room, you may be the only ones who are not monsters. There are natural monsters. And the reason I say that goes back to Aristotle, founding father of so much philosophical terminology. And particularly the terminology I'm interested in is the distinction between the form and the formless. For Aristotle, any determinate reality, anything you see, any person you see, is a combination of form and matter. Matter on its own, well, doesn't really exist on its own, but it's formless, it's chaotic. It needs to be formed. And that's not just a matter of physical shape, but also a function of something being the kind of specific thing that it is. Now, one of the things that Aristotle wrote an awful lot about, which isn't often read, perhaps, is his books about animals. And if you get one of those big, thick volumes of Aristotle's work, you find big chunks of it are about the movement of animals, or the generation of animals, or the history of animals. And it's in that, a lot of that work, and also in his Physics, that he talks about monsters and monstrosities. And for Aristotle, a monster is something that is deformed in a way, or that has an excess or deficiency of form in relation to what it should be. Or perhaps it's a combination of different forms in a hybrid or a confusion. At the same time as he labels these as monstrosities, he also thinks they're natural, in a sense. They're part of the product, the workings of nature, the natural spontaneity that you find in natural processes. There are certain things that Aristotle thinks happen by absolute necessity, but there are lots of other things that don't. For example, all of us in this room are unique in the way we look, the size of our ears, the colour of our hair, our fingerprints, and so on. So all of us have that essential humanity, which Aristotle would have acknowledged. But we also have individuation, things that make us individuals. And those are the things that can be spontaneously different. Nature doesn't have to produce humans according to some cookie-cutter identity. We don't have to look the same. And, in fact, that divergence is part of natural spontaneity. So the production of monstrosities is simply taking that a little bit further. What if you have a human with six fingers instead of five? Or a human with an extra arm? Or, to give an example that Aristotle talks about from Empedocles, another philosopher, an ox with the face of a human. It's taking it a little bit further, but it's on a continuum with what makes us natural beings, that spontaneity of nature generating this profusion of forms, not according to some precise identity. Now, it's also true, of course, that for Aristotle, there is a hierarchy amongst these forms. And another reason for saying that there are monsters among us is that Aristotle's biology of sexual reproduction is quite significant here. In the conception of an embryo, according to Aristotle, the woman provides the matter, the unformed, chaotic matter, which is given form by the semen that the male supplies. So you can kind of see where this is going already, can't you? The woman provides, if you like, the base stuff, the raw materials. It's the male contribution that enables that matter to be formed in the shape of, but also with the rationality of, a human being. Now, if all goes well in conception, according to Aristotle, you only get male children. If something goes wrong, slightly wrong, you get a girl. So he actually says that girls, or women, are human beings but with an incapacity. Now, he thinks it's good that there are female children because it works according to nature's ends. This is what nature wants to produce. So he's got this strange contradiction going on that, in a sense, if all goes well in conception, it works mechanically perfectly, you only get men. But in order to fulfil the ends and goals and purposes of nature, you have to have women too. So it's actually quite good that you have these natural deviants, which are women. And that's not all, because, of course, for Aristotle, there are natural slaves. There are people who, because of the place in the world that they're born, because of the climate of that place, are naturally suited to be slaves. And the reason for this is because they lack a certain capacity of practical reason. So he didn't deny that these people were intelligent in many ways and they could perform technical tasks well, but they lacked a rational apprehension of the good and the ability to match their actions to achieve that goodness without direction. And the thing that women and natural slaves have in common, therefore, is that they both are unable to direct themselves. This is why you need the male principle of order and control and rationality. Because the natural slave, like the woman and the child, any child, needs to be guided towards the good and can be utilised by the male towards that end. So the slave performs an even lower function than the woman. So slaves can be women too, of course. There's an equal opportunity enslaver. Now, That means that the monster bears a relationship to certain categories of what Aristotle acknowledges are human beings. So remember, monstrosity is produced by nature's spontaneity in generating these forms, which are deviant in many respects, but which are not done by nature in vain. It's one of Aristotle's principles of his physics. Nature does nothing in vain. It doesn't do everything identically. It produces variety, and this is actually to achieve the good ends of nature. So producing women and men achieves nature's ends. Producing natural slaves achieves nature's ends, because it gives the free men somebody to use to achieve the good. So you have this monstrosity, not just, if you like, at the border of our humanity, as something extra-natural, but something within nature, something as a power of nature, an expression of nature's spontaneity, generating these hierarchies within the human species. And monstrosity comes to be something that's very much at the heart of what it is to be human, whether you're deviant or in control, according to Aristotle. If we move then from Aristotle, this is a bit whistle-stop, but anyway, move forward a few hundred years to the medieval period. There's a book by David Williams called Deformed Discourse, which has argued that the monster, the figure of the monster, plays a really important role in much religious writing, theological writing of the medieval period. And he did so for a good reason. A lot of it was influenced by this tradition of theology called negative theology. Now, if you think of these people trying to conceptualise God, or the absolute, or being, with a capital B, they conceptualise God as utterly transcendent, as beyond language, as obviously beyond the world, beyond any form that could grasp it, or limit it, or define it. So how do you talk about this? Well, negative theologians tended to say, well, you need to say what God is not, you can't say what God is. But alongside that, there was also a tradition of approaching God through monstrous imagery. And a guy called Pseudo-Dionysius, well, I don't know if he's a guy or not, an author called Pseudo-Dionysius, who pretended to be Dionysius the Areopagite, a New Testament figure, but was actually 6th century, wrote some compelling books about mystical theology, which recommended talking about God in strange, monstrous ways. And the reason for that was, it was curing you of this tendency you have to try and grasp what is beyond your comprehension in something that you can in terms that you can define and understand. Monstrous imagery, I mean, he talks about God as a worm, and people who follow him talk about God in relation to other hybrid monsters. You can't take it literally. You know God is not like that, but it's helping to free you from this rational desire for order and control. So that monstrous discourse plays a role in liberating you, liberating your reason, from the narrow tracks within which it normally runs, in which we think there's a definition, there's a concept for everything, and the job of language is to represent something to us. Well, actually, here, the job of language, the job of this monstrous language, is to cure us of that need or desire for control and definition, and expose us to something beyond our comprehension. So the monster there is a limit, in a sense, and that connects, in many ways with what Fred's saying. But it's also a threshold, a gateway into something beyond the human, with which we as human beings can be united. So you've got two kind of aspects, I think, of monstrosity coming through in this Western tradition. The idea of a natural monster, if you like, creating hierarchies amongst human beings, because monstrosity emerges within human nature in a purely natural way, according to Aristotle, to create these deviances and these hierarchies. But on the other hand, a positive appraisal of monstrosity by this medieval tradition, which sees it as a gateway into the incomprehensible, as a way of almost kind of giving form and figure to the fact that you can't give form and figure to the divine, to the absolute, to the ultimately real, but that is beyond your grasp and beyond your comprehension. Now, the role of the monster in connecting with the divine, defining the human, defining nature, is carried through in different ways. Obviously, we could talk about different philosophers and different philosophical periods, but I think one way in which it comes through into modernity, to me, is found in the German philosopher Hegel. Now, Hegel saw the history of thought as a historical process. He always saw it as the unfolding, the self-expression of God through history in different forms of ideas, philosophy, culture, society. So it's a progressive story of rationalization, purification. And he saw the progress of religion like that. So you started with crude forms of religion, where the gods represented in animal form or in monstrous hybrid form, and you moved towards the purity of Greek religion, where the human form is dominant. That's then carried through, so you move beyond polytheism to monotheism and so on. But one of the interesting, stroke troubling things then about the way in which Hegel uses this progressive account of religion and thought is, for example, the way he talks about the Jews. The existence of the Jews is a problem for Christian thinkers because the Old Testament is supposedly surpassed by the New. The Messiah has come, so what are the Jewish people still doing? You know, why are they still here? It's a problem for Christian thinkers. And Hegel, it's a problem for Hegel too. This is a stage of religious history that's supposed to have been surpassed. And the way he talks about Jewish people in his early writings, and it's character in a slightly more toned-down version in his mature writings, but the basic idea is still the same, is that the Jewish people represent an alienated and monstrous form of religion. Unlike Christianity, where God appears in person and unites people to God, in the Jewish religion, he argues, God is distant and a commander. And the followers of that God are basically slaves who are mechanically following this dead religion. I mean, it's an old anti-Semitic sort of an anti-Jewish trope, but Hegel gives it a particularly kind of vivid expression. And so the Jewish people are talked about by Hegel as approaching the condition of animality. They are human, but they are beast-like at the same time, in the sense that they enslave themselves. And go back to Aristotle's category of the natural slave. For Hegel, the natural bit's kind of gone away now, because the Jewish people should have moved beyond that stage, and they haven't. So they're willful slaves. They're a perversion of the course of history. So he's using monstrosity now as a way of obviously demonising and othering an entire people. But it becomes much more the kind of threat to progress and order and unification and so on than it is a gateway to something else or simply an expression of nature. Hegel was quite interested in science of the brain and how different parts of the skull could represent different characteristics. And it connects with some 19th century, 18th century science where skull shape, physiognomy, profiles of people, you know, literal physical profiles of different races, were used to represent different stages of civilization. So what was for Aristotle a fairly constant state of affairs, for Hegel it becomes a historical state of progression, that different races represent different points on the ladder towards some kind of perfection or some kind of realization of what it is to be truly human. Now in all this you have the potential to also find the monster as a figure of subversion and contemporary things. I won't talk about it, maybe I'll talk about it in the discussion afterwards. Contemporary figures have tried to take this philosophical history in all its contradictions and its complexities, because it's not just like one story that all these figures are telling, but to take it in its complexity, this idea of the formless within nature, the formless leading beyond nature, the formless threatening nature, and all these are figures of the monstrous, that which has no form, which confuses form, which undermines the form of order. And they've been able to use this as a subversive motif. I mean, some of you may know, for example, a famous feminist poem by Robin Morgan, simply called Monster. And she appropriates that idea of the monster, taking it from an occasion where her two-year-old child saw her coming out of the bath naked and started giggling and said, "Monster," at her. And she takes that, and it's a kind of very profound and painful reflection upon patriarchy and issues, politics of sexual liberation, but using that term, monstrosity, Another example maybe we'll talk about is Donna Haraway. He writes about cyborgs, so the incorporation of technology into the biological human, disfiguring and re-changing it. And she's aware of all the problematic elements of that. The way it's militarized, this technology, the way it's subject to capitalist flows of control. But she also sees in the cyborg a potential liberatory metaphor. So this very contemporary monster becomes a sign of utopia, something that is formless, that resists being captured by these narratives about what's natural or what fits into the historical progress towards the truly human. The cyborg, she says, has no nature. It has no origin story. It becomes an offence and a scandal to the way philosophers often try to ground accounts of what it is to be human in nature or in a historical narrative. So I think I'll end there before my circuits break.
Thank you. And our final speaker is Sarah Wood.
I'm going to grab the lectern again.
Just the wrong size, isn't it?
Is that good? Okay. Are we up for it? Monsterism asks for some nerve, and there are some things that you can't be ready for in monstrosity. Whether it's a stripped-down monster's astir inside you or something close by in the atmosphere, flickering too fast like a strobe, or demonstrated on such a massive scale that you could easily miss it. Showing up is a practical matter. Being here and listening is simple, but it makes room for complexity. We turn out on a winter's night in the hope of experiencing some emergent quality, a tremendous and risky edge of the monstrous. We might think of its inchoate multiplicity, its unheard-of combination of unassimilated elements coming at us. When Danielle invited me straight away, a line rocked up, like one of the wild thoughts that the psychoanalyst Wilfred Bion liked to talk about. I remembered it was from James Joyce, Ulysses, the Cyclops episode. And as you know, Ulysses follows the voyage home that the Greek hero Odysseus took from the Trojan War. It's this big cultural cornerstone. In Homer, the human Odysseus, or Ulysses, and his crew encounter and escape monsters, nymphs, and enchanters on their way home. And of course, Joyce's novel Ulysses is itself monstrous, massive, parodic, hybrid, assembled from parts, constantly flying off into this or that tone, register, topic, mood, period of literary history. Knowing the author and the title didn't anchor my monster sentence in one context. On reflection, even on rereading, the sentence stayed wild. And it was that monster audience simply rocked with delight. That monster audience, what is that? Is it some kind of poetic figure? It moves as one. One being rocking with delight, with laughter. Rocking, you move while you stay where you are. You balance. But the feeling of the sentence is unbalanced, exaggerated, weird. Is it a baby? And simply, it's simply rocked with delight. How is that simple? And of course here, simply is an intensifier that means that this is true, absolute, real monster laughter. It drowns out thought. The line seems to suggest an audience that can't think, doesn't listen, doesn't divide following different paths of association, that isn't diverse or plural, and is more than happy to experience the loss of diversity and plurality being amply paid in delight. Earth is now being monstered, left, right and centre, back down the years and going forward, on multiple fronts. And in a way, we're having trouble getting hold of, even those of us who want to. Mass extinction of wild animals, the number living on Earth is set to fall by 2/3 by 2020. Stephen Hawking emphasises the value of humanity pulling together as a species. He says, "For me, the really concerning aspect of this is now, more than at any time in our history, our species need to work together. We face awesome environmental challenges, climate change, food production, overpopulation, the decimation of other species, epidemic disease, acidification of the oceans." And Hawking is describing what we might call emergent events that take us beyond the continuity of history. Happenings new in a way that finds no readily available or adequate discourse that we might use to represent, discuss, or judge them. And humanity is getting a new sense of itself, its particular identity, precisely in relation to its destructiveness and its vulnerability. And that's part of what the term Anthropocene means. The environmental thinker Timothy Clark raises the question of scale. One meaning of monster is gigantic or abnormally large. And then there's a sense of monster as anything deviating from the normal course of nature. Clark describes the way events are outrunning our collective apparatus for receiving and understanding them. This is what he says. "As the Earth turns into a novel, partly incalculable, hybrid entity, where human effects interact in emergent ways with partially understood ecological systems, with counterintuitive interactions that cross the continents, many habitual modes of thought, understanding, and action now emerge as constituted by a kind of increasingly anachronistic scale framing. That is, discursive practices that construct the scale at which a problem is experienced as a mode of predetermining the way in which it's conceived. Monstrosity, I think, starts to deconstruct that construction of scale, to loosen the connections between experience and conception, to challenge habitual ways of understanding and assumptions about how to frame our interactions with ecological systems and their hybridized indirect effects. It is inevitably challenging, confronting, and demanding." That monster audience, to come back to the phrase from Joyce, means the audience is very big and it's behaving like one giant thing. In fact, it's laughing at an execution scene in a way that's sentimental and grotesque, as if dictated by a weird reflex response. The historical reference is the execution of the Irish Republican Robert Emmet in 1803 and his farewell to his fiancée, Sarah Curran. The monster audience reacts without thinking. Nostalgia is the keynote, idealisation and stereotypical prefabricated feelings. The condemned man's childhood sweetheart shows up on the scaffold, and this is the passage in Ulysses. "She brought back to his recollection the happy days of blissful childhood together on the banks of Anna Liffey, when they'd indulged in the innocent pastimes of the young, and oblivious of the dreadful present, they both laughed heartily, all the spectators, including the venerable pastor, joining in the general merriment. That monster audience simply rocked with delight, but anon they were overcome with grief and clasped their hands for the last time." The vapid exaggeration signals there's something wrong. The state execution of a rebel might seem to be the strongest kind of authoritarian imposition of control, but it's as if there's no one in charge of the prose. The tone is beyond off. There's no one narrating, no speaker, no one responsible. The phrase is part of a sentence in an emphatically written document, a parody of journalism that interrupts the progress of the realist narrative of Joyce's novel. Leopold Bloom moving through his human Dublin day with careful precision, fidelity to the map and the clock. We're reminded that Ulysses is made of words and assembled out of different genres. The Cyclops section, named after that one-eyed monster in Homer, cuts between a pub scene, narrated by a narrow-minded anti-Semite bigot, whose favourite word is I, and samples of various kinds of descriptive writing, newspaper sports columns, society pages, news items, letters, and so on and so on. Now I've got an image. No, it's the wrong way. We've got an image? Yes. Okay. I hope this doesn't seem like a ridiculous way to address monstrosity. I look at Ulysses deriding Polyphemus by Turner, and I find that the monster is very hard to make out. Polyphemus, meaning many-voiced, is the particular cyclops who Ulysses and his crew encounter. Where land, sea and sky meet, Polyphemus resembles a cloud, a mountain. You can see at times maybe a head, there's a bit of arm, which I think is just sort of here. It's as if I don't have enough eyes to find him, or enough words to hold on to him. Ulysses and his men on the ship are turning towards this something or someone in the sky that they have robbed, mutilated, blinded, tricked, and escaped from. And naturally, the next thing they do is to laugh at him. And if I follow their gazes, this cruel little figure of Ulysses here, with what looks like a handkerchief in his hand, is... Yeah, I try to see what they're looking at, and derision's pointing the way for where you might look to see what you see where the monster is. I suppose that they're shouting, but even so, I don't see a single clear, simple outline, but indecipherable painting out of which images come and go. For Turner's Victorian champion John Ruskin, Polyphemus had it coming. For Ruskin, Ulysses is simply Turner, all suffering artist, human and in the right. Turner, Ruskin says, had been himself shut up by one-eyed people and thrust the rugged pine trunk all ablaze. This is a reference to the horrible way in which Polyphemus was blinded. And thrust the rugged pine trunk all ablaze, rough nature and the light of it, into the faces of the one-eyed people and got away to open sea as the dawn broke over the enchanted islands. The one-eyed people, the Philistines, the Cyclops, are what, in this version of reality, the artist has to fight and overcome in his art. And it's true that in Joyce's Ulysses, the Cyclops episode parodies bigotry and censorious sentimentalism. But art is bigger than polemic, and the contemporary artist concerned about climate change, food production, overpopulation, the decimation of other species, epidemic disease, acidification of the oceans, Hawkins' list, can't just leave Earth or blame monsters. Getting away to the open sea, complacently leaving the wounded monster to stew in his own juice, seems to me like wishful thinking. And this brings me to dreams and the monster words that they bring to light. Myops, for example. Myops is the short-sighted monster, the myopic monster. Freud invents the word in a dream. A dream is a very complex form designed to include what in waking life one might not want to bring together. The dream word sometimes precedes the thing, leading the way. Freud is interested in how dreams inventively condense language, like poetry. I'm interested in how that might make a difference to the problem language has, how to accommodate monstrosity without rendering it phonily familiar and innocuous. Emergent events of the kind that are occurring across the earth today need words and sentences that are not yet habitual, a little hard to see. We need refreshing, strange, and memorable condensations of what threatens to overwhelm us. Words that nudge us beyond the tendency we have to say, yes, I know, or to dismiss difficult facts with criticism, ridicule, and bluster. Words are not afraid to be mad. Freud insists that dreams are often most profound when they seem most crazy. And he says that the work of condensation is seen at its clearest when it handles words and names. It's true in general that words in dreams are frequently treated as if they were things and are apt to be combined in just the same way. Dreams of this sort, he says, offer the most amusing and curious neologisms, or we could translate that as offer words that are funny and strange. Myops isn't the only word that Freud dreams up. He dreams a new adjective, norecdal, calling it a monstrosity composed of two names. And the short myops dream leads to a dream with another new, quite meaningless word, ungaseris, the negative of a real Hebrew word, gaseris, meaning imposed suffering or doom, or more colloquially, weeping and wailing. And there's a lot more that can be said about that word, especially in 2016. Freud dreams myops in the context of the university and education. I had a dream, he said, that a man I knew on the staff of the university said to me, my son, the myops, Then followed a dialogue made up of short remarks and rejoinders. And after this, however, there was a third piece of dream in which myself and my sons figured. So as far as the dream's latent content was concerned, Professor M and his son were a mere screen for me and my eldest son. And the whole dream is incredibly rich. It appears in a section of the interpretation of dreams called Absurd Dreams. And Freud explains it touches on Jewishness and concern about one's children, to whom one cannot give a country of their own, concern about educating them in such a way that they can move easily across frontiers. The myops turns out to come from a conversation Freud had with a friend about the biological significance of bilateral symmetry in living things. His friend had begun a sentence with the words, "If we had an eye in the middle of our foreheads, like a cyclops." Freud associates this with the schoolboy son of his colleague, who had an infection in one eye, and there was a lot of concern that it might pass to the other eye. And Freud's own wish to save his own son from the doom of being, quote, short-sighted and one-sided. Hence the appearance in the dream of myops, and behind it cyclops, and the reference to bilaterality. Freud finds that in this dream as a whole, there is a wish to contradict one-sidedness of intellectual development. And that seems like a good moment for me to stop.
Thank you. I think we'll go ahead and take some questions straight away. So if we take two or three and then we can speak to all of them. So these two.
Hello, thank you. First question to, so actually there's a little thing to Dr. Wood, you can speak about that in passing, but actually the word myops is a Charon word in ancient Greek.
Oh, really?
Yes, so for example Aristotle uses it and so on, so I don't know what Freud is doing with that. But, you know, I mean, maybe he's dreaming up an existing word, which is not impossible. Just to say in passing. There's a few things, I mean, something maybe that can bring everyone together. I was expecting actually from Professor Bodding's talk about Derrida and nonsense and pets. I was expecting to hear something more about the future in Derrida. So where Derrida says monsters cannot be announced, and so the monster then later becomes the future. So going back to the etymology of the word monster, is the portent, is the announcing sign, the monstrum, as you say in demonstration. And so on, so that the future becomes the figure of the monster in Derrida. I was expecting to hear something more from that, and then they can be bring together also Dr. Shakespeare, because you spoke about cyborgs and how, you know, we have that futural anticipation. So, and then you were talking about Hawking's idea of the need for the Anthropocene and the need to sort of move on. So maybe you know, the question of the future, the question of the sign as a monster, as such.
Thanks. I think there was another question behind me.
Thank you very much for the talks. You've given them a very, very interesting. I have a question, maybe bringing the first two speakers together. So Dr. Botting talked about, you know, the fourth function, which wasn't quite clear yet, or needed to be kind of explored more. There was something that you mentioned about perhaps a protective function that the monster takes on now that it's being deformed itself. And Dr. Shakespeare then spoke about mysticism and how the deformed discourse kind of allows us to grasp something that there's maybe representation and language doesn't have direct access to. So I was wondering if maybe, so these two things, the protective function and the mysticism, make me think of the figure of the golems. And I wonder if that's maybe already somehow in there, that's maybe a new function that it's taking on. I don't know if it was a question, but maybe it's just trying to think both of these things together.
Thank you. So should we speak to those? So the relationship between the future and monstrosity and something about the protective function of the monstrous.
Yes, I mean, that's quite a good way to deal with the gap that I left at the end. You're quite right. Jacques Derrida does, and this is way back in the 80s talk about the future as being necessarily monstrous. To be a future at all, it has to be unpredictable, incalculable, non-programmable, he says, doesn't he? And then about 20 years later, he writes an essay, or it's an interview, on the promises of monsters, or where he begins to doubt himself. And this would sort of fit in with his work with Bernard Stiegler. That this future that is uncertain, unpredictable, monstrous, gets increasingly programmed. I think its relevance in different types of science, the control of nature, calculable definitely in terms of technology and economy. And so there's a kind of encroachment on the possibility of humanistic, in the broadest possible sense, discourse. That it still depends on something accidental, unpredictable. That is what guarantees it. The more it is programmed technology, economically, militarily, the harder it is to find any sense of the monstrous in that optimistic way that he uses. Instead, we probably need to distinguish two functions or two senses of the monstrous being that sense, particularly that Sarah drew out, around ecological catastrophes, uncertainties, planetary and level anxieties, which are multiplicitous, not easily containable or imaginable. And the monster, which might be then more defined as a specific thing that condenses and focuses these anxieties, energies, can then be turned into, as Derrida says, a pet. And that may be where the kind of protection, screening off function comes. It's a way, almost like sort of Freud and metaphor and condensation, drawing together a number of often divergent, deviant, problematic elements into a single, not quite object, but image, metaphor, monstrous, that then becomes the focus to put aside or hold at bay, or even in the term Stephen was talking through, Hegel, to get seriously, nastily racist about. There is a kind of nasty element to that. So the kind of protective function can be a screening of, it also can be a containing and destructing role. And I think that's what happens to the future in that kind of level of thinking with Derrida's sort of changing term.
I suppose that there's nothing necessarily that great about the openness of the future as such, because it easily gets colonised, kind of promise of the new, the novel, the flows of desire that infest that generation of novel possibilities in the new. And of course Derrida's not really after that. He's not really after something that follows that kind of calculated code, but in a sense that's what's presented to us as the future. I suppose for me, the monstrous being this figure of a kind of material excess has that capacity for resistance to narratives about the future, you know, progressive narratives about the future, as much as to the unbearable aspects of the present. So I don't tend to kind of think of it so much in terms of the future. That's why I kind of, in some ways, I'm interested in the mystical discourse about monstrosity, suspending representation and interrupting that sense of us having things under control and having things predictable and neatly laid out and formed in advance. But I suppose you have to think about the agency of the monstrous as well. I mean, I was thinking of, there's a bit in Marx, in the Communist Manifesto, obviously it begins with a famous statement about communism haunting Europe. But there's a bit later on where, talking about the bourgeoisie as this sorcerer, I can't remember the exact words, but it's something like bringing up from the netherworld these forces, and meaning the, in a sense, the kind of formless proletariat, which has no natural place in the hierarchy apart from it, you know, what it can sell as a commodity. It becomes a commodity itself. And I suppose the hope then is, can that take an agency? Can that take not just be a symbol of something, but actually take its excessive force and, you know, use it? And it almost kind of echoes, I think, this idea of the golem raising up from the sorcerer raising up this being from the netherworld, which is a very strange thing and needs to be animated in some way. And whether it can, like Frankenstein, get its own agency and its own resistance to its maker. So anyway, I'm kind of starting to burble now, so I'll pass on to Sarah.
Yeah, agency, that seems really important, agency in the question of change. I suppose one of the things that was going through my mind when I was thinking about this was just, you know, the event horizon of the occasion itself and the audience and my own nerves and all that kind of thing. But precisely because this is an interactive event, that there's no knowing how it will go, but there's also no knowing where it will go. And that we come together and there's a hope that something nice happens in the room, but then there's always, yeah, there are kind of after effects, and then there are utter distractions, and someone, you know, even as I speak, might be having an amazing idea, you know, quietly on their piece of paper. So I kept moving between a sense of the monstrosity of totalization, the monstrosity of taking the monster as any one thing, or taking the future as any one thing, and something uncontrollably disseminatory, and also always wondering what it's like to go into a room and say we. And what kind of a we are we at the moment? And how do we divide? I'm interested by the fact, well, you were thinking about Jewishness, and Jewishness kind of came up in what I was thinking about in Leopold Bloom and for Freud. But the monstering that goes on of refugees, all kinds of monsters, and there's Trump, isn't there, and Boris Johnson, and these people that we enjoy disliking, I presume. And but what's really going on with them, and what will happen, and how much use are these monsters that look like monsters to the monstrosity of reality? And could there be a good monstrosity, a kind of dream monstrosity? I mean, I just think you're already thinking about this.
I think it's interesting what you're talking about in terms of the kind of subversive potential of monstrosity. And how do we acknowledge and accommodate monstrosity without domesticating it in some way? But you seem to be saying there's a very clear good monstrosity and a bad monstrosity. How do we avoid classifying them in that way? How do we keep it monstrous whilst kind of letting it be subversive, I suppose? How do we know it's good subversive rather than bad subversive?
Yeah, no, it's usually good, isn't it, to try not to get it right, to try for something else than that. Yeah, I mean, reading, thinking tends to kind of move into play, doesn't it? And play seems to be a way of disturbing the regulatory functions of good and bad and allowing something to happen. But yeah.
Because I think, Fred, you were drawing attention to a kind of domestication of monstrosity that we seem to be witnessing, and you seem to be a bit disappointed with that.
Well, it kind of, yes, I know what you mean. You want a monster. You know, even if you kind of read, you know, horror fictions or whatever, and you want them to be scary, nasty, and even those fail, aren't you? Or they get domesticated.
But aren't you being too prescriptive about your monsters?
In a way, but that was just kind of a semi-joke. The other aspect is that, I mean, it's kind of semi-joke, but you do, but this sense of the future or something being monstrous, unpredictable, Stephen sense possibly even mystical, that is a way out of a kind of very contained and constrained set of differentiations and demarcations in the thinking of the present, if you like, economically, politically, socially, just about every possible way. So I was just thinking, I'm trying to formulate it in the way that kind of Stephen talked about Marx. There's another set of monsters in Marx, not just the emerging proletariat, and Marx doesn't call them a monster. That would be, as it were, conservative discourse. The mob, the proletariat, the workers. Marx talks about monstrosity in terms of the factory conditions, the joined together machines, the turning of bodies into automaton. And he talks about this great vast, monstrous automaton in Capital. So his kind of, the way you politically direct your definitions of monstrosity and how, you know, open you are or otherwise to other possibilities can be a way of both offering a kind of openness to an uncertainty that you can't prescribe and at the same time moving away from a conservative locking off or locking down. And of course the famous one in Marx is the function of this really strange thing called Capital, the vampire metaphor that he uses to describe that endlessly revolutionizing, tradition tearing up process of accumulation of surplus value that is about sucking living life and turning it into dead labor. Now, that's an attempt to sort of give form to a kind of non-totalizable system that, if we follow through, I really like, and I've never kind of, no one ever kind of think, oh, it's a cheap metaphor. Actually, it's quite a good metaphor to something superstitious, something blood-sucking, something antithetical to life, something restrictive, something with a monologic which is just reinvest surplus, accumulate, no matter what. It's a very, you know, and I think it's quite a good metaphor to try and keep and to try and sort of envisage. So that might be one way, you know, so you kind of keep a negative function of monstrosity, but just apply it to the right thing or non-thing and give it, no, and the right then is a political choice, not a, yeah. A general one.
Should we take some more questions? So one there and then one at the front. Yes, you.
I've got two questions. Does anyone know the etymology of monster? I don't, I'm just asking, because that might be interesting.
Well, I think the gentleman was pointed to it. It's monstrum, so it's in the word demonstration. So you could say showing, often associated with a sign or a portent. So monsters might be like a sign or a portent of something gone wrong or something in the future that's bad. Or it might just be a showing in some way. I mean, like in the medieval discourse, it's showing something that can't be told in a sense. But it's to do with showing signs, portents.
There is one other derivation, which is from manere, I think, meaning to warn. Right. So it becomes a kind of cautionary, so it has that limiting effect. I think the two versions, I've kind of always hedged between the two, work really quite well. So one is a kind of more, you know, if you go down to the woods today, in a kind of that way. It's sort of a big surprise. I mean, it comes almost pantomime, but there can be a cautionary element to it.
The other one was, in stories, there seems to be a kind of convenient divide between what types of monsters you come across. I know that this was your topic, but I thought there was another one. There seems to be a monster that comes from the land, and the sea, and the sky. Land monsters seem to be attacking us. Sea ones are kind of unknown ones that we've sometimes pissed off, and then they attack us anyway. And then sky ones are unpredictable ones that attack us. I don't know what the implications of that are, but I've always thought that sea monsters were the scariest because they're just the unknown ones. We don't know when we're going to annoy them, then they just turn up.
Thank you. And there's a question at the front.
I actually have a comment. First of all, about the definition, as you said, in ancient Greek, for example, monster, teras, it's the divine element, the omen. So it's a sign of the gods. So somehow it is connected with a divine revelation, as you said, about the medieval period. So we not only have Aristotle about the monster, but also we have this kind of aspect. And of course, monstrare in Latin, which is to exhibit, to reveal, to show. But I would also like to say about, I think that a single definition of the monster is impossible. So this is something that we already saw from your presentations. And I would like to say about Rosie Braidotti and what I really find fascinating in her definition of the monstrous is that she doesn't really talk about an object or a thing, but about a mechanism that produces differences and negotiates a relation to alterity, because it has this characteristic of having the same and the other at the same time. So she also says at the end of this text that we will never get the monstrous because it's always going to flee. So we will never get it. Maybe, I don't know if it is going to be a pet, but it seems that it is always going to be away from us. So I don't know if you would like to say something about
that. Should we take one more question before we... Yep.
Thanks, guys. Fascinating stuff. I'm a teacher. I work down the road in East London, and I'm teaching my A-level class, Frankenstein. And one of the remarkable things about, wonderful things about teaching Frankenstein, slightly subversive things as well, is that you often end up with a class of monster apologists who all say the same thing. So, don't worry, sir. It doesn't matter that this thing has killed several people. Often the discussion centres around, in that particular novel, whether Victor Frankenstein, the creator, is more monstrous than the creature, if you like. One of the things I think my class has found quite instructive is the way... And Peter Brooks, of course, says the same thing. The monster's eloquent, and we can call him human. Whereas Victor Frankenstein, not so much. His language is often characterised by hyperbole. It's very easy to mock him and criticise him, isn't it? And my class has a lot of fun kind of suggesting that he's the monster, if you like. One of the things I think they find quite useful is looking at what Anne Radcliffe says about... she makes a kind of distinction between terror and horror, and this kind of feeds into what we talk about in class about the sublime. And I wonder to what extent you think kind of monsters are terrible in the sublime sense. They're instructive, they're morally useful to us. And to what extent we kind of see them now as horrible. Is there a difference between terrible monsters and horrible monsters, do you think?
Thank you. Okay, so three questions there. So one about types of monsters, land, sea, and sky. One about Braidotti and the mechanism of monstrosity, and the monstrosity is something that flees. And then one about the difference between terrible and horrible monsters. Let you pick.
I'm happy with Frankenstein.
Try to think about monsters coming out of the sea now.
I don't know about the land, sea, and sky one. There's someone else's. I'll have a go at Frankenstein. And you're quite right. The amount of apologists for a serial killer is amazing when you teach that novel. But this is where I think a lot of what Sarah, you should be answering this, Sarah was talking about. The way the novel... That novel picks up a kind of romantic set of models of sublimity of nature, but romantic nature, as Frankenstein performs it, is a very individualistic, male, creative self version of this is where I'm going to find my true being, blah, I'm going to conquer nature. And we actually haven't talked about the kind of removal of the kind of natural base for Aristotle, and then in the kind of Frankenstein's doing it for the first time. Nature gets stripped away. He can now have power over life and death. But it's set up in the novel as a very kind of romantic, individualist, antisocial activity. And then you have the monster speaking on behalf of, if you want to kind of lefty thing of the yet-to-be-human classes of to be human. And that's where I think there's that kind of tension. So it doesn't matter if you kill a few people on the way, and that's fine. But then there's the element of how the text, and this might be an answer to another question, the text doesn't resolve that. And the kind of way that Frankenstein as a novel, as a text that gets rewritten, that plays off different perspectives, but refuses any kind of final answer. I can't even remember how it ends in the kind of frozen waste, isn't it? Of the
darkness and distance.
Darkness. So, and there isn't a kind of final reading imposed on it. You just get sort of frames and more questions. And I think maybe that's where a kind of ethics about its politics, its gender politics, its science come in. It doesn't kind of flatten it out and say, well, let's kill the monster, bang, done, as a lot of the films do, but keeps those questions going about who, what is the nature of monstrosity, and that might be where, you know, there is a different kind of sublime, not one that's sort of highly elevating and returns to self, but is kind of interrogative and questioning. Which might work with Bradotti as well. So you've got self and other, and then the condition of production and engagement, which is always opening up another possibility. So you've got, you know, Frankenstein, monster, and the novel, the text, the condition of, you know, by a woman in this case, that's even better, opening up that possibility.
I like we say about Bradotti, and the idea of the monster always slipping away in a way, because we're also in the medieval era, you get these taxonomies and bestiaries of monsters that classify them, and it becomes this paradoxical attempt, because if the monster is what defies form, how can you then put it into an order and a form again? And I think that tendency to try and domesticate the monster has been there from the beginning, in a sense. It's not necessarily in itself new, because you can see Aristotle is trying to naturalise the monster and keep hold of that idea that form ultimately wins out. Even with deformity, it's still part of that same process. And yet, I mean, one thing that just came to mind when you're talking is like when Socrates says, Socrates famously says, know thyself, right? But he says, when I think about myself, I'm not sure if there's a part of me that's divine or a part of me that's like Typhon. And Typhon's this monster that's the product, the child of Earth and Tartarus, sometimes seen as having 100 snakes' heads and fire coming out, or snakes writhing around its legs, and a gigantic figure. And almost like Socrates there at that moment of self-knowledge, not knowing which side of that threshold is on. Or actually maybe being on that threshold is part of his whole philosophical enterprise. It's not about finding the form, it's about negotiating that boundary in some way.
You get the Lancian sky.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, no. This is all, and it does all feel like it connects, doesn't it? Because I feel as if this Turner scene does something with those elements, and if looking at a painting, kind of going in a kind of Lacanian direction, involves looking for an objet petit, looking for something which escapes. An activity which is rather passive of a sort of contemplation, and where images and thoughts, or if it's a text, interpretations can kind of come and go. I feel at the moment very much on the side of just kind of hanging around and thinking, hanging around and talking, kind of listening, not doing too much. Because what and allowing in a kind of negative theological way, uncertainty to proliferate, just because those who are certain seem so terrifying. I'll just sort of play on the beach for as long as I can.
Maybe something about the water, though, because I suppose it's the... It is very much where we're out of our element, isn't it? And the abyss.
What you come from?
See me later.
Should we try and squeeze in a couple more questions? Yep.
Thank you. My question is about a couple of references you've made to children and monsters disappearing. So there's a couple of things of Aristotle defining a child as monstrous, maybe, because they're not directed, and then Freud's child being monstrous. And then also the references to the kind of development and evolution of humanity and the onward march of progress becoming more developed. So is the point of a monster to be a monster, or is the point of a monster to be neutralized and normalized or demonstered as a child grows up? They're no longer a monster, or as humanity evolves, we're no longer monstrous. And then I guess going back to some of, is it Professor Botting's initial ideas about where do monsters go now? Are they disappearing because we are laughing at them and demonstering them?
Yeah. Thanks. And there was one question towards the back. If you could be as quick as you can.
Hey, sorry?
Yeah, just say it.
Thanks. My question is, how inevitable was the rise of the monster, and also to what extent do you think the monster is a manifestation of human repression? And by that I mean like the kind of dark pleasure people get from hating Trump and people like that.
Thank you. So something about children, and then something about the pleasures of repression and the...
Yeah, I really like this child thing. I think that's right. I think that's a that's a growth point of the thinking about the monster. And it seems to me the hallmark of the most sophisticated forms of thought, that they can go into the child and they can go into the hate, that they can bring those things into play. And the notion of play, I suppose, has its associations with childhood. Yeah, I mean, it feels very poignant in the Freud, the thought about his son and all the sons and all the children. And children are so vulnerable. And that seems the vulnerability of the monster, which kind of is seductive. And your classroom story, yeah, that would be my story too of teaching Frankenstein. But in universities, I think it's really important that there's kind of contact with the child in the sophisticated discourses. I think that's very important. And in philosophy too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole talk of the child as not yet, they're potentially an adult, and what's important is what they'll become. And I hate that. It's like they're a person in waiting, and I think, you know, that misses all the kind of wildness of what's going on, really. And there's so much that's kind of plugging them into the future anyway, you know. And the systems that we've got to test and measure and channel children to what they should be. My oldest son's 9, and he's worried about how he's going to buy a house. I mean, I know he's a strange 9-year-old for that, but, you know, is that kind of generating this kind of, oh, what's going to happen next? It's kind of sad, I think, that it is a kind of domestication of the monster, but in a way that fills that void with anxiety rather than anything else.
You've got 1 minute.
1 minute, okay. Yeah, this kind of works if you go to connect the two. On the proviso that monsters don't exist. They are produced, either through effects of oppression and construction. Therefore, if we take the child as the object, or the formless matter in this case, we can make monsters. And maybe we are making, monsters to maybe some of the older members of this audience, but beings that are incredibly good at hitting performance targets, incredibly functional, incredibly career-orientated, house-orientated, and that scares me when I go to schools and what they have to do at A-level now. The kind of... What that does to level, I don't know if that's monsters, it might be kind of neuropaths or God knows. But there is a kind of level of production and how monsters are produced and in what terms might be the question.
Okay, we have run out of time. Thanks very much for coming. Join me in thanking our speakers again.